Our community has not been silent since then, demonstrating, because we do not want one inch of this existence of the state, and we realize that what they're doing, the horrific crimes, what they're doing to the Palestinian people, mm-hmm. as I say, we have been standing there crying, demonstrating, and certainly the last few weeks, in fact, there was a viral video showing how Jews were just recently, a few weeks ago, brutally beaten. We went outside in the streets of New York, and we go to Washington, our car tires were slashed, and we get death threats. But this is nothing to what happens in Palestine. And if it wouldn't be for this, you should know there would be tens of thousands out demonstrating. If it wouldn't be for this fear, the Zionist brutal attack on the Jews who are real Jews, who are true to the religion, true to our Jewish religion, and are constantly suffering with the people of Gaza and Palestine and the West Bank.
Well, let me talk about that, because looking at the powers that be, because you said in your community, the anti-Zionist Jews have continually to be out there and speaking up against the regime. What about places like the United Nations and official entities? Have you spoken there? Have your community gone there to protest this absolute support that it has for the Zionist entity?
Yes. We are an NGO. We do go there constantly. I mean, since I'm a child, we've been going to the United Nations demonstrating almost every week. I was there just 2 weeks ago. We're constantly demonstrating outside of the United Nations with large demonstrations, small demonstrations, constantly. In the United Nations itself, they don't give us a voice because we're politically incorrect, because we clearly state unambiguously, unashamedly, we pray for the speedy and peaceful dismantlement of the Zionist state of Israel. We do not consider two-state a solution, because they have no right to occupy even one inch. I carry with me, I believe I have it in my pocket, we carry a key. We went to visit Sabra Sheltila, Baja Barajna, and they gave me a key of that they remember the homes in Jerusalem, they want the homes. We support this. We cry with them. They should be allowed to return. What do you mean they should be allowed? It's theirs. The United Nations should be demanding that they should go out to the state. And just like the United Nations made a mistake, forgive me for saying so, it's the United Nations, but they allowed and supported the South Africa during the apartheid, and the ambassador was called His Excellency, and that's how they referred to them, while they were practicing racism, and they believe in God, they said. And today, everybody understands that racism is criminal. Who doesn't understand? It's basic logic. And because of the grassroots, people, good people like you, good people like the average people who stood out on the street and went and screamed till the politicians were uncomfortable.
Do you think they stopped a change? It's changing.
And of course, so I'm saying the United Nations today, of course, South Africa is a, and yet the United Nations was the one that ratified the creation of a Zionist state that declares, and with the majority populace was Muslim, that they could create such a called a Jewish state. It's not a Jewish state, but that they could create a Jewish state. What would that mean? If you're looking for a world body that was created to create peace on the world, how do they ratify a situation where you're going to take a minority, that their name should be the name over the land? That's calling for strife and unrest and hate. Right. And that's what they did.
Well, Rabbi Weiss, hate to interrupt you, but we only have a couple of minutes. Do you think that there's a transition, that we're in a transition, that there's a change on the horizon as more and more people seem to be becoming aware of what the Zionist entity really is and standing up against this genocide?
Well, look, we're not prophets. And we've gone through the 75 years, sometimes that looked much more hopeful, sometimes it looked less hopeful. But we knew and we know that God is compassionate. And the Torah says, why are you rebelling against me? It will not be successful. There will be an end of the occupation of the Zionist state of Israel. We pray it should be, he should do with his compassion, speedily and peacefully. We know that we've been always demonstrating, and we have to continue to demonstrate, even if it looks black. But at that said, we hope that maybe at this point in the history, where the world sees the totally unexplainable, unforgivable mass murder of the people of Gaza, maybe this is the time that we, in Judaism, it says, one of the statements of the Torah, it says, from sour comes sweet, from bitter comes sweet. Maybe from this will be the time that the world will say, just like in South Africa, something's wrong, we made a colossal mistake, we have to stop the occupation. And that doesn't mean the Jews can't live together with Muslims. Again, I went with people in Gaza, I met with the leadership of Hamas and with Hezbollah in Lebanon. They embraced me openly, unabashedly. They said, we have nothing against Jews. History shows that the world, then the United Nations has to face the history that we if you remove the impediment to peace, this political, flawed, selfish occupation, then we will live together in peace.
Okay, and that's what we're hoping and praying for, the removal of that impediment. Thank you so much, Rabbi Weiss. It is a pleasure, as always, speaking to you. And thank you for being with us on this Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye for now.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Indonesia's support for Palestine is deep-rooted. This support predates Indonesia's independence, so it cannot be shaken so easily by the Zionist propagandists. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, in the last few days, Israeli media has been reporting about Indonesia mulling normalization of relations with the Tel Aviv regime to fulfill the requirements for accession to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, and neoliberal market-based alliance countries. The news circulated at a dizzying pace on social media platforms and triggered a wide array of reactions from netizens worldwide, including in Indonesia. It wasn't something they were expecting. Indonesian Foreign Ministry was quick to deny the reports in a midnight statement, saying no such plan was in offing. The ministry spokesperson, Lalo Muhammad Iqbal, said, I affirm that, as of now, there are no plans to establish diplomatic relations with Israel, particularly given Israel's actions in Gaza. Most people in Indonesia reject and condemn any plan that leads to the normalization of ties between the two sides or Jakarta's recognition of the apartheid colonial entity. Several notes can be taken from this frenzy. First, the behavior of the Israeli media, citing anonymous sources to report on Indonesia's plans to normalize relations with Israel. It has happened several times in the last few years. Indonesian Foreign Ministry has always denied such reports. It again denied it, and then it was as if there was nothing more. There was no apology from the Israeli media, nor was there any criticism of the Israeli media from the Indonesian side. Indonesia's support for Palestine is deep-rooted. This support predates Indonesia's independence, so it cannot be shaken so easily by the Zionist propagandists. In 1934, when the Palestinians fought against the British, at that time Indonesia was still colonized by the Dutch, the clergy in Indonesia collected donations from the people to help Palestine. It is also recorded in history that a rich Palestinian businessman, Muhammad Ali Taher, in 1944 donated a large amount of money to the struggle for Indonesian independence. In history lessons at schools, our teachers often repeated the phrase, "Palestine was the first to recognize Indonesia's independence." What it actually meant is that after the proclamation of Indonesian independence on August 17, 1945, the Indonesian diplomat M. Zain Hassan came to Egypt to promote recognition of that independence. In order to support Hassan's efforts, a number of resistance figures in the Arab world based in Cairo founded Lajnatud Dafa'in Indonesia on October 16, 1945, including General Saleh Har Pasha, Secretary General of the Arab League, and Abdurrahman Azam Pasha, Chairman of the Palestine Committee. The recommendation from the Lajna was a resolution to support the Republic of Indonesia and an appeal to all countries, especially Arab and Islamic countries, to recognize the new republic. After that, almost all the Arab countries recognized the Republic of Indonesia one by one. Apart from that, Indonesia initiated and hosted the Asia-Africa Conference from April 18th to 24th, 1955, the first conference of formerly colonized countries in the world whose main spirit was to liberate all the colonized people on Earth. Support for Palestinian independence was one of the dominant issues at this conference. Indonesia has a historical burden to maintain that spirit and fulfill its promise of independence for Palestine. The third point is, it needs to be acknowledged that there are indeed parties in Indonesia, both politicians and prominent figures, who are secretly establishing personal relations with Israel. Indonesia's decision to submit a membership application to the OECD, an organization controlled by Western capitalist countries, instead of joining a new economic power that is far more promising for shared prosperity, namely BRICS, shows the dominance of the West in Indonesia's economic posture. Membership in the OECD requires the consent of all members, including Israel. It is very possible that there are figures behind the scenes who are trying to normalize Indonesia-Israel for their interests, especially business interests. However, they never expressed their intentions openly because it would be tantamount to political suicide. No politician in Indonesia would dare to commit suicide at this time, when public sentiment is very strong in supporting Palestine and against Israel's genocidal crimes in Gaza. Thus, it can be concluded that the rumors of normalization were Israeli propaganda that took advantage of the tendencies of a few parties behind the scenes, but which immediately hit a wall of failure. The Indonesian people will not allow that normalization to happen, as Indonesia's first president, Sukarno, stated, "As long as the independence of the Palestinian people has not been handed over to the Palestinian people, the Indonesian people will always stand up to challenge Israeli colonialism."
Farewell to the arms.
Part 1. The moment of farewell is one of the hardest moments for anyone. Whether it is saying farewell to your family, your home, your homeland, and the most significant of all, saying farewell to life. But for a fighter, the hardest one is to say farewell to their arms. Palestinian fighter and leader Yasser Arafat was a man who experienced each and every one of these farewells throughout his life. Now, he had turned into a comatose in a hospital bed in France before he experienced those farewells. His first painful farewell took place 50 years ago when he witnessed a series of events that changed his course of life. It was springtime in the small village of Deir Yassin. The inhabitants of the village did not want any war with the intruders. But sometime later, the United Nations divided Palestine into two Arab and Jewish sectors and caused rifts instead of solving the differences.
The resolution of the Duck Committee for Palestine was adopted by 33 votes, 13 against, 10 abstentions.
After the UN resolution, the Palestinians possessed only 45% of their country in two disjointed segments, namely the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. The rest of the 55% was given to the minority Jews with a 500,000 population. By recognizing Israel as a so-called state, a war started. Now the Jews could expel the Palestinians out of their homes and replace them with the newly arrived Jewish immigrants. 6 months passed since the final declaration of the United Nations, but normalcy had yet to be restored to the cities. The people of Palestine did not want to come to terms with the injustice. Everyone knew that the war was looming. People in Deir Yassin were seeing the migrant Jews in their neighborhoods. They didn't want to be the initiators of war. They were preparing for a new harvest season. But the sun had just risen when 120 Israeli armed men surrounded the village. The people of Deir Yassin faced what they had feared most. Deir Yassin was the first place to burn in the flames of war. The stench of major atrocity filled the air in Palestine. The Israelis killed more than 250 civilians, including women and children, and over 100 children were left orphans. Other cities and villages faced Deir Yassin's fate one after the other. Palestinian men sent their families to safer cities and took up arms to defend their homeland. After a few months of popular resistance, the armies of Arab nations rushed to the Palestinian people's rescue, which led to the first Arab-Israeli war. year later, Israelis were the winners of the war. The 65,000-strong army that had come from seven Arab states to help the Palestinians could not do much. There were less than half the Israeli forces in numbers. On the other hand, the Israelis' newly purchased equipment compared to the Palestinians' old and dilapidated equipment, made many people disappointed. The immigrant Jews, who had only purchased only 2% of Palestine's land from the British, were now occupying 70% of the land. The war claimed the lives of 25,000 people and left 700,000 Palestinians homeless and displaced. They migrated to neighboring countries. People lived cold and grim lives away from home. Their only hope was to return to their homes one day. After a few years, a new ray of hope shines for the Palestinians. This time from the West. A man came to power in Egypt. People are infatuated with his ideas. His words smell like freedom. Gamal Abdel Nasser's ideas are an inspiration for nations seeking independence. He sought to revive the pride of Arab nations. He forced thousands of European troops who've been occupying Egypt for decades to pack up and leave for Britain. The people were filled with joy. Gamal had an idea. He wants to unite Arab nations so they can gain independence together. But there's a major obstacle in his path.
About the rights of the Arabs of Palestine were expelled out of their country. We have about 1.5 million refugees. They treated the Arabs the same way. Expelled them, killed their children, destroyed their villages, and there was escape from Palestine to the Arab country. The Arabs of Palestine want to return back to their homeland.
The Israeli army decided to conquer the entire Middle East. Their military equipment is made up of the most modern French warships and warplanes, and the United States is also beefing up their military by handing them more than $60 million in military aid each year. But worst of all was the news of atomic weapons being produced in Israel's nuclear sites. It meant that the Israelis were not going to give up so easily. Gamal had initiated various projects to empower Egypt on par with Israel and was now holding war games so he can flaunt his country's military might to world leaders. The flames of the war would either burn Israel or it would shatter Gamal's dreams. Tensions were on the rise along the borders. The armed forces on the Jordanian and Syrian borders were on high alert. To support them, Gamal deployed 80,000 troops to the Sinai Desert and the Gaza Strip. The King of Jordan traveled to Cairo to sign a defense pact with Egypt. Syria and Iraq also joined the pact. Middle East turned into a powder keg. A single spark could burn it in flames. Israel found itself surrounded from all sides, so it declares a state of emergency in all of its military bases. The commander of the Israeli army claimed that they're ready to enter any war the next day. All eyes are fixed on Gamal, so he'd start the war and end the Israeli entity before it could celebrate its 20th birthday. As a next step, he blocks all maritime crossings for Israel. Gamal's nightmare came true. Israel strikes preemptively and turns the tide in its own favor. Israeli jets destroyed more than 400 Egyptian aircraft and their hangars. The Jordanian army orders a counter-strike in revenge, but the Jordanian fighter jets disappear from radar screens one after the next. The outcome of the battle on the ground was not so different from the one in the air. Once again, people had to flee in order to save their own lives. Israel only needed 6 days to grab enough land to make itself three times larger. Syria's Golan Heights, southern Lebanon, the Sinai Desert in Egypt, and all of Palestine up to the River Jordan were occupied by Israel. Other Arab nations ended up with the same fate as the Palestinians had. Now half the population of Palestine had to live under Israeli occupation. It seems they had to give up their struggle for freedom. 9 months later, the news of an explosion shocks everyone. A roadside blast targets a bus in Israeli-occupied territory, leading to the death of two Israelis. The Israeli army announces it will give an unforgettable lesson to the fighters who carried out this attack. A small group named Fatah claims responsibility for the operation. Their base was in a small town of Karameh, located near the Jordanian border. Gamal was worried a new war would create trouble for Arab states, so he asked the Fatah forces to immediately leave town. The Jordanian army made the same request, but Fatah members wanted to stay, even if it meant they had to give up their lives. Israel thought such a small group wouldn't be much of trouble for them, so they immediately sent 15,000 troops and 50 tanks to the village. But they were ambushed and surrounded from behind. They were trapped and in the first few hours suffered over 100 casualties. Israeli forces received a lethal blow, so they retreated. The Jordanian artillery also rushed to the rescue of Fatah and struck the retreating Israeli forces. Now, all that remained from the so-called invincible army was a few abandoned, burned-out tanks. Fatah broke the myth of the invincibility of the Israeli army. The leader of their group was one of the hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees who did something astounding to achieve his goals. The man who always had a smile on his face and would never give up. In August 1929, the sixth child of the Arafat family was born. His father named him Mohammed Yasser, meaning the bringer of relief, to give hope to the family in hardships. His Palestinian family had migrated from Al-Quds to Egypt a few years back, but the hard times came to him sooner than he expected. He lost his mother when he was just 4 years old and laid her to rest. And his father had to send him to live with his uncle in Al-Quds. Yasser witnesses the conflict between Palestinian freedom fighters and British forces in Al-Quds up close and personal. After a while, he goes back to Cairo to study. His first year at the university coincides with the hard days for Palestine and the start of the first Arab-Israeli war. He joined the Arab nation's army to go fight for Palestine. However, after a year, they suffered a defeat and he thought he should perhaps pursue his studies. He applies for a visa to study at the University of Texas in the U.S. It took a few months for his request to be processed. Yasser, meanwhile, changed his mind and decided to stay and fight to return to his homeland. At first, he held discussions and forums about Palestine. In one of these discussions, he revealed his plans. He asserted that armed resistance was the only way to save Palestine and founded the Fatah movement. He planned a series of operations, but everything should have been done secretly. But the second defeat for the Arab nations was a heavy blow for him. This time around, he planned an operation in the heart of Tel Aviv and immediately claimed responsibility for it. When he was asked to retreat, he responded, "The Palestinian people have always been fleeing, but this time we are going to resist, even if it costs us our lives." Only 48 hours after Arafat's victory, 5,000 people asked to join the Fatah movement. Arafat's popularity grew by the day, so Israelis decided to immediately take him out. Arafat became so popular that everyone called him leader of the Palestinian nation. They said, "He's come to shine the ray of hope in the heart of the Palestinian nation." Fatah grew bigger and bigger by the day. After a year, the Arab nations recognized Fatah as the only official Palestinian organization. Gamal, as the most important Arab leader, also backed it. The Fatah movement's successes aroused the Jordanian king's jealousy. And in no time, a conflict started between Fatah and the Jordanian army. Gamal acted as a mediator and asked both sides to stop fighting. Arafat agreed, but the next day, Gamal said farewell to life after a heart attack, and Arafat, who had just set out in this path, lost his important supporter. Arafat was forced to relocate the Fatah movement's headquarters. Lebanon was the first destination that Arafat chose to continue his fight against Israel. Although he had many opponents in Lebanon, his backers give him and this cause all-out support. Yet, Arafat did not believe that Lebanon's support for the liberation of Palestine was enough. Arafat's trips around the world made headline news. He embarked on trips from Asia to Africa and from Africa to Europe to find new supporters. Only a few days after victory of the Iranian Revolution, he traveled to Iran and the first Palestinian embassy was established in Tehran in his presence. People in occupied Palestinian territories knew Arafat very well. He wanted to get the world on board in order to wrest back the occupied Palestinian territories and soon got what he was looking for. He traveled to New York and for the first time, a Palestinian speaks about Palestine to world leaders for an hour. And everyone gave him a standing ovation. Everyone but one group.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Chawit, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Let's talk about the same topic that, in fact, we started from, last episode, and that means enjoining the good and forbidding the evil, and some of the jurisprudential laws related to that, Sheikh Chawit. And let me start with this question. Is it permissible to neglect or ignore, let's say, enjoining the good and forbidding the evil for fear of losing one's job? For example, the head of an educational institution who deals with the university youth commits actions against the Sharia or paves the way for commission of sins in that particular place, while we fear of losing our job if we forbid him from this evil.
Well, as we discussed in one of the previous episodes, one of the conditions that must be fulfilled when enjoining the good is that one should be safe from any harm. And if you are not safe, that means actually Amr bin Ma'ruf and Nahy anil Munkar are not obligatory on you. So as a general rule, if the duty-bound person fears considerable harm for himself in enjoining the good and forbidding the evil, it will not be obligatory for him to engage in such a practice.
I see. Well, Sheikh Chawit, if the good is neglected and evil is common in some places, let's say, in a market or in an academic environment. And the conditions for enjoining the good and forbidding evil are there. Will one be relieved of performing this duty if one is single?
Well, when there is a case to enjoin the good and forbidding evil, and the required conditions are available, it is you know, the shari as well as social and human obligation of the mukallafs, the duty-bound people, to do so. I mean, they should do whatever they can to stop the evil and promote what is called virtue. So such things as being, for example, married or unmarried, I think does not change the ruling. And of course, merely being unmarried does not exempt one from carrying out this obligation, which is obligatory on every individual who has attained puberty. Now, regardless of your age, regardless of the position you are, so if the conditions of fulfilling, of enjoining the good and forbidding evil are available, then you have to do it.
Mm-hmm, I see. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Stay tuned.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Shaita with our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. Sheikh Javid, if one comes across evidence of sinful conducts, impropriety and insincerity of a person holding a powerful position, so that one fears his power and influence, is it permissible to neglect enjoining the good and forbidding the evil in relation to that individual? Or is it obligatory for one to call that person to the good and forbid him, let's say, from evil, even one is afraid of that individual's harm?
Yeah. Well, if there's a reasonable and genuine fear of harm coming from that individual, which you described as someone who is powerful, who is, threatening, so it will not be obligatory in such cases to enjoin the good and forbid the evil, because the condition is not met. One of the conditions is that one should be safe from any harm, and in this case, maybe the individual who enjoins the good and forbids the evil is not safe, because he puts himself in harm's way by enjoining someone who is very aggressive, who is very violent. So, of course, such a person is relieved of the obligation of Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahy anil Munkar. But meanwhile, it's not good for someone to neglect reminding and advising his brother in faith simply for fear of the position of the person who neglects the good, or that of the perpetrator of the evil, or for the mere likelihood of some harm inflicted by him. So if there's a chance, or maybe likelihood or probability, one should not take these seriously and into account stopping Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahy anil Munkar.
Sheikh Javid, don't you think that it also necessitates a kind of negotiation techniques, like or psychological, for example, techniques, so that we can somehow smooth talk
yes,
to the person, and don't go, you know, hard or radical and cold turkey on the person. And we somehow don't be straightforward and frank when it comes to it. And could we use some indirect techniques?
You're right.
Let's say to somehow talk the person into doing something good and talk him out of doing something bad.
You're right.
Doesn't it necessitate that kind of technique?
I think you are very right, much right. Because in this time around, being very rigid and strict, and let's say very much outspoken in terms of conveying that message of Islam, mm, and spreading virtue,
or convincing the person
it does not work. Mm-hmm. You know, you can, as you rightly mentioned, you can act in an
indirectly
indirect way to draw his attention and to remind him of his duty to do what is good and to stay away from what is bad.
Like, I remember the story of Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein trying to teach that old person, the senior citizen, how to make the correct or proper wuzu, right?
Yes, yes.
And they went up to the person and they asked him which one of us, in fact, makes proper wudu, you
sure,
know, without telling the old person directly that you're wrong in the way that you make the wudu, you know.
Good.
So this is the indirect technique, basically.
Of course, yeah.
All right.
For example, if you tell someone straight away, why don't you offer, it's haram that you don't offer your prayers, and it's a great sin to, he will take offense, and he,
yes,
he will react.
Take guards and
yeah,
reactions.
Reaction will
things
be, yeah. It will have no effect. Rather, he will further get, you know, distanced from the religion.
So taking the right tone and discourse is very necessary,
necessary.
Like the knowledge that you talked about in one of the previous episodes about the religious issues. If you don't know the knowledge,
yes,
if you don't know, you know, the correct things, the sins, or whatever the good deeds, then how can you enjoin somebody to the good or forbid him from evil?
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
اللهم صل على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and shortly with our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. Sheikh Javid, Sheikh, at times forbidding a sinner creates negative feelings against Islam due to that individual's ignorance of Islamic duties and rules. On the other hand, if we leave that person alone, it will prepare the ground for others to corrupt the environment and commit sins. So what's the duty, what's our duty in this regard?
Well, enjoining the good and forbidding evil, when the conditions are available, are considered public religious duties.
Right.
For sake of safeguarding Islamic laws and social health. So it is a collective duty, and every individual should in his own turn fulfill this duty, because everybody needs to contribute to the social health,
mm-hmm,
in one way or the other.
Right.
Well, the mere suspicion that it might, you know, create negative feelings against Islam in some individuals does not actually justify the negligence of such an extremely crucial duty.
Mm-hmm. Sure, so if those assigned by the government to prevent corruption do not accomplish their duty well, is it permissible for people to take action or to take charge of this duty themselves?
Well, it's not permissible for other people to interfere with the affairs assigned to judicial authority, or security personnel,
mm-hmm,
because they have to do their jobs. Intervening or interfering in the affairs of those people who have, for which there are certain people responsible,
mm-hmm,
is not okay, because it will create further chaos and lawlessness. So there is no objection to enjoining the good and forbidding evil when carried out with due observance of the limits and conditions. So we did talk about the limits and conditions. So conditions must fulfill. One of which is, of course, that one should it should have the necessary effect. It should not have the negative consequences for the individual. And then, if all of these conditions are fulfilled, then one can go ahead. And of course, in judicial matters, one should not take the law into his hand, arresting people,
that would cause
beating them,
mayhem and chaos in the society, right?
Beating them, imprisoning them, jailing them, and lashing them. That's not okay.
Yes.
And this practice is not endorsed by Islam and the Islamic Sharia and the scholars, the Shi'ite scholars. I'm not talking about the scholars from, let's say, other branches of faith.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Ashtavit. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, as the host of this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker, we bid you farewell. Keep us in your du'as, and thank you for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun Malajah Ilaha Illahum Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun Sami'un Basir Ilaha Illahum وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
In the limelight. A British government advisor on social cohesion has described attempts to portray protesters on pro-Palestinian marches as extremist and outrageous and dangerous. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. British ministers are considering proposals to ban MPs and councillors from engaging with groups such as the Palestinian Solidarity Campaign, Extinction Rebellion, and Just Stop Oil. The plans put forward by the government's advisor on political violence, John Woodcock, say mainstream political leaders should tell their representatives to employ a zero-tolerance approach to groups that use disruptive tactics or fail to stop hate on marches. The British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak and James Cleverly, the Home Secretary, are due to discuss the proposals as part of a review conducted by Woodcock, the former Labour MP who now sits as Lord Walney, a crossbench peer. The Prime Minister was condemned by human rights groups for warning of forces trying to tear us apart during a hastily arranged address in Downing Street recently. He was charged with exaggerating tensions at protests after he warned of mob rule in Britain. In an article in the Sun newspaper, Lord Walney wrote, "My review on political violence is about to be formally submitted to the Prime Minister and the Home Secretary. In it, I'm asking the leader of every mainstream political party to take a zero-tolerance approach to the threat that is threatening our democracy." Lord Walney added, so Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer should instruct their MPs and councillors not to engage with anyone from the Palestine Solidarity Campaign until they get their house in order and cut the hate from their marches. The proposals are politically convenient for the government because, if accepted, they would put further pressure on the Labour leader Keir Starmer over his party's stance on pro-Palestine demonstrations. Several sitting Labour MPs have attended Palestine's Solidarity Campaign events, including the former Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell and the MP for Poplar and Limehouse Absana Begum. Labour has refused to suspend MPs who have attended events despite demands from senior Tories, because the Palestine Solidarity Campaign is not a proscribed organisation. The Conservatives have previously engaged in talks with Extinction Rebellion, including the Levelling Up Secretary Michael Gove, whose department is working on the definition of extremism as part of its brief. Ministers are looking at broadening the new definition to cover groups that officials claim their actions undermine the UK's institutions, as previously reported by The Guardian. While Environment Secretary in 2019, Michael Gove met Extinction Rebellion and said afterwards he shared their high ideals to tackle the climate crisis. Labour leader Keir Starmer is already under pressure to allow Labour representatives more freedom to condemn Israel's actions in Gaza. After George Galloway's emphatic by-election victory in Rochdale, where 18% of the population is Muslim. Many within the Labour Party believe it points to anger felt by Muslims over the party's position on Israel. A shadow frontbencher questioned whether the Labour leadership had gone far enough in dispelling false narratives on pro-Palestine marches. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story and tells us more. A British government advisor on social cohesion has described attempts to portray pro-Palestine protesters as extremists and dangerous and outrageous. Dame Sarah Khan, who is carrying out a review of the resilience of the UK's democracy for Michael Gove, said such claims risk further dividing the country. Hundreds of thousands of people have been regularly massing on the streets of London to protest against the bombardment of the Gaza Strip by the Israeli regime. The former Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, has described the demonstrations as hate marches, and the government's Commissioner for Counter-Extremism, Robin Simcox, wrote in the Daily Telegraph recently that London had been permitted to be turned into a no-go zone for Jews every weekend. Speaking to the Daily Mail, before Robin Simcox's comments were published, Dame Sarah Khan said she believed the United Kingdom had a problem with extremism, but that people should be careful in their language. Dame Sarah Khan, who was Simcox's predecessor as the government's counter-extremism commissioner, said, "I think it is really important that we don't conflate those protesters, somehow saying or portraying them as somehow as being all extremists." She added, "What I've been really uncomfortable with over the last couple of weeks is a kind of argument that they're extremists on these demonstrations. I think that's actually outrageous." Dame Sarah Khan was appointed as an independent advisor for social cohesion and resilience in 2022 and is expected to complete her review this month. The Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has not gone as far as some within the Conservative Party in criticising the marches in London, but he has recently warned against the protests. Jonathan Hall KC, the government's independent reviewer of terrorism legislation, warned, however, against attempts to curtail freedom of expression and freedom of assembly on the basis that it might make some parts of society unhappy.